Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to be joined this summer week by Josh Blank, research director for Same Texas Politics Project. Summer morning, Josh.
He says that looking at me in shorts and sandals. I guess you could say that.
Yeah, I thought maybe either you're...
I'm wearing a full tux on top, though.
Yeah, we'll make this doubly insidery. You're either feeling very summery and or maybe going to lunch with one of your colleagues in the government department.
It's kind of, yeah.
That's actually what I'm doing tomorrow.
Yeah.
That said, we'll move away as quickly as we can from the visuals of the podcast. So, you know, speaking of the podcast, since we are last here, still more going on.
Yeah.
We're recording this week on a Wednesday because I was out of town, and I appreciate everybody on this end accommodating that. When we met last week, it was like, whoa, earthquake, right? The session had ended. They had not passed a property tax bill. Attorney General had been impeached, and the governor had just called a special session and called everybody back immediately.
And I think by that point, the House.
No, it was that day.
Okay, great. Okay,
I think that was sort of happening as we were recording the podcast.
Right. Well,
to wit,
yeah.
The House went into special session that day. Suspended the rules to pass two bills that were tailored to the governor's special session call, and then gaveled out aggressively, as several people have noted, including the lieutenant governor, gaveled out sine die. In other words, basically said, okay, we've done what the governor has asked us to do. We are now leaving again, we are now going to actually leave, which we had been hoping to do the night before. Now, just to refresh everybody's memory, the two subjects that were on the governor's call for a special session were very specific. He called for legislation to cut property tax rates, and I'm quoting from the call, solely by reducing the school district maximum compressed tax rate in order to provide lasting property tax relief for Texas taxpayers. Okay. And we're going to focus on that, I think, today, but also... he also called for legislation that was solely for the purpose of increasing or enhancing the penalties for certain criminal conduct involving the smuggling of persons or the operation of a stash house. I'm pretty sure almost certainly the first time the phrase stash house appeared in a call for a special session.
It's been a good session where they define drag performance and legislation and stash house.
But as has been widely commented, these are very specific.
Yes.
Yeah, in what they're calling for. So the House came in. Again, suspended the rules so that the bills didn't have to, go through all the pauses in terms of the scheduling of committee hearings, the process, the hearing of the bills and then the movement of the bills through the process.
Delays between
which should have, had they followed the normal process, that would have taken at least some matter of days.
Yeah, I mean, you'd imagine.
We can sit there and add them all up, but
Yeah.
To do it on a more leisurely schedule, it would have been...
At least 2 to 3 days.
Yeah, at least, you kind of think about what the layout rules are. If you weren't suspending any of the rules and the referrals and all that, would have taken some days. They did not do it that way. They did something that led a lot of people to say, the House is looking a lot like the Senate. Yeah. I mean, I heard a lot of inside kind of grumbling, even people that are taking the House's side in the House-Senate by kind of saying, there does seem like, we always knew that the rules are very flexible, or as, people colloquially say, there are no real rules in the Senate.
Yeah.
And again, not true, but the sense. But I mean, I have, you know, several people kind of going, you know, what is going on here where the House is going to come in and suspend all the rules and do this and get out? I mean, there's a sense that it was yet another sign that the process has really changed for people that follow this a lot, right? Or have been following it for a long time. Now, we can explain all that by the politics, and we want
to. Well, just to be fair, I mean, just to make you know, I love to give people benefit of the doubt. I mean, just to be fair here, they also did move out two bills that they had already gone through the process.
Yeah, well, there were some editing.
But primarily the idea is the main vehicles.
Yeah, they were starting from scratch.
So I mean, just for the thing of like why you have all those delays and those pieces, I mean, generally it's so that like there's time to consider, there's time for the public to weigh in. But if the feeling was, look, we've already considered this, the public has weighed in, you could make the case that all those steps and delays are maybe not as essential to the public process, if not the inside process.
So what you're saying is you are kind of on the side of the House. I'm just kidding.
Not till the end.
So
don't ask me now.
But no, I think that's right. I mean, look, you raise a good point that those rules have a reason.
Yeah.
And they assume kind of a certain setting and context
I'm going to post the bill so people can read it and people can have time to show up and generate some arguments for and against it. Like, but again, we're past that part. I mean, we've had that happen.
And for those that watched the relatively brief proceeding, when those two bills were laid out, the bill sponsors came and said, hey, members, this is just, you know, we've talked about this. You've seen this bill before. These are the things that we've changed to tailor to, you know, what was in the special call and, you know, let's get it on. And they did.
Happily.
So essentially they passed those two bills, and on the first day of what is allowed to be a 30-day special session, they got it done in a few hours and gaveled out, and everybody more or less went home.
Yeah.
And left it, this bill, then it was basically here's to the Senate and to Lieutenant Governor Patrick. Here you go. We've done what the governor asked. How about you?
And, you know, this is a lot of people seem to sort of miss this kind of key point about what happened here and what it meant, right? Because the House gaveled out Sinai, which means they say we're not setting a day to come back. It's without a day is what it means. And basically, as a legislative body, if they don't set a day to come back, they're not going to come back until either constitutionally required to do so or the governor calls them back. The important point for what you understand about the politics of this is that what it means is it created a take it or leave it situation with the Texas Senate, because if the Texas Senate, because, you know, again, government 101, right? The same bill has to pass both chambers and then be signed by the governor. Because the House passed this bill to the Senate and then left, any changes the Senate make, the House could not physically ratify because they're not there. And so therefore that creates a situation automatically that says, here's the bill, take it or leave it, because if you do anything, it's automatically dead.
Right. So two points to make about that. One, he said this was basically I'd say my way or the highway, but since the House here just snuggled right up and aligned with what the governor wanted, it's sort of our way or the highway, is the message to Lieutenant Governor Patrick and the Texas Senate. Now, the other point that we should make is an asterisk, and we're going to come to this again, but there is a provision in the Constitution that is open to interpretation, but that the lieutenant governor certainly interprets a certain way, which we'll get to. And then we'll just read it. Article 3, Section 17 of the Constitution is subtitled Adjournments, and it says neither house shall, without the consent of the other, adjourn for more than 3 days, nor to any other place than that where the legislature may be sitting. So,
I guess
we could unpack this, you know, and go down this rabbit hole. And, you know, I've talked to a couple people, though, you know, the parliamentarians are a little too busy to ask about this, although I suspect we would get different versions from the two parliamentarians. But the governor, you know, Lieutenant Governor Patrick is saying, look, you guys could come back. Now, the motion to adjourn sine die, as I would understand it, would be the motion to adjourn sine die. We'll look in the rules and again.
We'll try to figure it out.
For the parliamentarians out there listening or past or future, you know, please feel free to drop an email on your view of this, because I, you know, I would, I'm honestly interested in what the arguments are.
Yeah, it's just to throw two questions into that hopper for the parliamentarians out there.
At least you're going to do our work for us.
You know, well, yeah, I mean, one, I would say, you know, is there any, you know, should we consider, you know, a special session versus the regular session as different entities, you know, as far as we interpret this? Number one. And number two, I mean, one other thought, you know, this is sort of the social scientist in me, whatever, says, well, you know, during the regular session, both chambers regularly adjourn, you know, for longer than 3 days, like around holiday weekends, for example, you know, things like that.
Right.
Does the other chamber need to has the other chamber historically signed
always
off on that?
Always written off on that. Yeah. So signed off on that.
Yeah. The idea is that, you know, is this really something that's like, yeah, this is in here and we should initiate this now? Or is this something like this is actually a reflection of practice that like we just didn't know about because it's so kind of pro forma?
And is there something more unique and distinctive about a sine die adjournment,
right. as opposed to setting a specific date.
Right. It's, you know, in other words, you know, is there an adjournment and then there's a sine die adjournment, or is a sine die just a trivial subset of adjournments and so it falls under this?
Okay, bonus points.
All questions, you know, and I've got somebody I was going to try to text about that may know, would have at least a strong view of this and have not gotten a reply yet, but I'm going to work on that. So, you know, I think we have to talk about for at least a bit is the politics of the disagreement between the two chambers. Mm-hmm. And that touches on some of the policy things, but really the politics. And now what this axis of conflict looks like with the governor and the speaker on one side,
yeah,
at least apparently, and the lieutenant governor on the other. And that's certainly
the public
pose right now. And I think you have to think about this in a fairly Russian kind of way, you know, to think, well, there's some other real thing going on here. But
I don't know about that.
I don't either.
Well, just to finish out the timeline, because, I mean, most of you already know this, but I want to make sure it's clear. You know, so the governor put out that very specific special session call. The House very quickly approved a measure that they said met explicitly the governor's special session call. They adjourned sine die. But the important point here is that in addition, then the governor came back and basically tweeted, that's it. They did it. This is great.
Good work, House.
Good work, House. Expect the Senate to move this along and we can go. So, I mean, he didn't just, you know, it wasn't just like we're interpreting that the governor is on the House. The governor put his finger. Now, this is important because the entire legislative session, as the House and Senate have been, I would say negotiating, but that's almost too generous. I'd say sort of, you know, fighting, whatever you want to call it, you know, in conflict over the method of property
tax. They negotiated
tax
publicly for 130 days.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly.
120 maybe.
Yeah, they fought for 160. But ultimately, you know, the governor, a lot of people noted that the governor had not entered this debate throughout the regular session. No point was it clear, at least publicly, that he was in favor of one approach or the other. I think, you know, again, just to be honest here as a, you know, quote-unquote expert, you know, my guess was that he had no preference in some ways, that whichever one would pass would be fine. But this was obviously a very different thing. We get to the special session, and now the governor immediately said, okay, I'm on – this is what I want, and this is what side I'm on this, which is
– You know who I think agrees with your assessment of the governor's preferences here? The lieutenant governor.
Yeah.
From the outset of the session, Lieutenant Governor Patrick had advocated for a relatively simple approach, all things being equal, that emphasized an increase in the homestead exemption for residential property owners only, which after some back and forth wound up settling in the final days of the session as an exemption to 100,000.
Right.
Which was a counter proposal that came from the House, basically.
And that's just the set piece now, it seems.
Right. And the House, and that has now become the governor's preferred position, and why not? Makes sense to me, you know, from his perspective. And then a House approach during session that focused on lowering the appraisal caps, the limit on appraisal caps, or the appraisal caps.
So how much your assessed value can go up from one, you know, assessment to the next, basically, for the purposes of taxability.
Right. Now, the governor's approach, as we've said, only unveiled in the special session call, near as I can tell, calls for a more complex but broad-based approach that would lower what is known as the compressed tax rate. And that draws in part on the approach that was implemented most recently in legislation passed in 2019. Mm-hmm. And it's worth noting, and we'll come back to this in a sec, that if sustained, this would eventually, at least theoretically, result in reducing those rates to zero.
That's my understanding of it. I mean, again, someone can you know tell us otherwise. But just
I think it's also the lieutenant governor's understanding.
I'm not ready to jump in and say that we're all analyzing this from the same point of view. Right. But I mean, but part of this is just math, right? The idea being here, if we're looking at the state for like average assessed rates, and then the idea is that those taxing entities that are above the average need to somehow lower their rates. Ultimately, if you think about it, what you're doing is you're taking, you know, essentially a distribution. Half of people are below the median, half of people are above the median. You say to the people who are above the median, you got to lower it. Well, next time the median moves down. And that just happens subsequently over and over
again. That's on purpose.
Yeah, and that's on purpose. But just to just understand, so like, how does that work? That's just, it's some pretty simple math, actually. You know, you just take out the people on the high end, the average goes down. That's all that we're talking about here.
Yeah, and it, you know, it will approach and, if left to its own devices, reach zero.
Yeah, at the limit, I guess they say in math, right?
So, you know, so from the outset of the session, the lieutenant governor, has been very much against the House approach.
Yeah, extremely.
Said that he had favored it earlier on in his career. He's seen the light. He thinks his approach was the smarter approach.
And not only that, but their approach is wrong. I mean, it wasn't, right. I mean, I would say, I mean, it'd be nice, you know, it wasn't just, well, you know, we can all be, no, it's like that. But in the end, I know that that's wrong now.
Right. And you know, to give, every Texan's Dick Levine another name check.
Yeah.
Because he got one from the lieutenant governor, though he mispronounced his name. Dick put together a good analysis for every Texan, a lot of good graphics, and we'll link that when we create a link for this podcast at the Texas Politics Project website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. We'll include a link to that analysis, okay, because I think it's useful. Now, you know, I'll extract us from the policy morass.
Oh, thank God. Okay, I'm sweating over here.
Yeah, even dressed for summer, you're sweating a little.
Yeah, no, this is...
you know, what has followed, you know, and I'm conscious of reducing this to the politics, but the politics are institutionally and I think historically important. What's followed is the most open conflict we've seen between the governor and the lieutenant governor since they were both elected to their offices in 2014. Now, that's not to say that from even that very first day that they were both inaugurated, that there hasn't been perpetual speculation, even assumption, that the relationship has always been something of a rivalry and has always been difficult.
The truth is that both of them have forged such different political paths and really, you know, and not to say that they don't, you know, have share obviously substantially overlapping constituencies, but just, you know, in substance and in style, they've really been just very, you know, I mean, honestly, just different politicians. And I think, you know, in some ways, to the extent that you have seen some open conflict, not like this, but open conflict between them, usually some of those underlying, I think, you know, again, sense of style, sense of where they fit in the ecosystem. Yeah. You know, that can really inform a lot of that discussion. I think we kind of are going to see that here too, right? I mean, to your extent, not to reduce it all to the politics, but when the politics and the policy and the personality all seem to go in the same direction,
because politics
and work together,
don't come from nowhere, right?
Right, exactly.
I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, I think from the very beginning, you know, it's fair to say that, you know, Lieutenant Governor Patrick had come to the office through the Senate, you know, prior to that being a talk radio personality and a, you know, and that was his entree into politics. It was much hotter. Yeah. You know, Governor Abbott had been, you know, essentially, you know, a guy who'd come up through the system. He had been a judge. He had been attorney general, UT Law School, you know, the whole, you know, very different paths, very different kind of approaches to politics and to governance for that matter. Mm-hmm. So
I'd also, you know, I just want to add one more thing as we're sitting here talking about it. But the other piece of this too is because they both entered, you know, again, offices at the same time and really, you know, again, at the same time and also in a similar position in some ways, you know, Abbott's coming in on the heels of Perry's long tenure. In a lot of ways, you know, the idea is that historically the Texas governor is considered a relatively weak position and the Texas lieutenant governor is considered a very strong position. But at the end of Perry's term, in a lot of ways, that dynamic
that had
flipped.
It had been transposed. That's exactly right.
And so Perry was the strong one. You know, former Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst was seen as being rather weak, you know, by, you know, certainly by comparison or historically even potentially. I don't know. I'd have to ask somebody else about that. And in some ways, both of them, you know, in the case of Abbott, he was trying to, you know, maintain at least as much of that, you know, power and juice in the system as Perry had, or at least get back to it close soon. And for Patrick, I mean, you can see he's done this. The goal and the effort and really the consequence has been to reinvigorate and strengthen the office of the lieutenant governor. And
right.
And that's necessarily going to create a certain amount of friction because there's only so much power in the system.
Right.
This is actually somewhat a zero-sum game at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's I mean, I agree with most of that. I mean, I think that it's set up, you know, these two offices are set up to be rivalrous.
Yeah, you can see
it's
that.
Part of the constitutional design is that, you know, that's why, you know, the lieutenant governor is not the vice president.
Right.
Right. By any means, you know,
right.
As we've seen in pretty stark terms. So, you know, and I think that, so, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the House's kind of in and out special response to the special session, and like, you know, I think we have to you can't really overemphasize to my mind that this was basically twice in the space of about 10 days that the House said, here you go, Senate, here you go, Lieutenant Governor, here's this flaming bag of you know what. The first was the impeachment of the Lieutenant Governor of the Attorney General. Yeah. The second was then this, okay, we've just done what the governor wants. You're going to go along with it, or are you going to put up a big fuss?
Right. Even worse than that, actually, we just passed the biggest, you know, tax cut in Texas history, and it's just waiting on the lieutenant governor and the Senate to approve it.
Right. And this after, you know, again, to be fair, we don't want, you know, that's the thing about these conflicts, you know, when you start the story can work to the advantage of the appearance of one side or the other. Fair to say that earlier in the session, the lieutenant governor had been doing a lot of that because of his control of the Senate. They rammed a lot of legislation through they moved a lot of it very quickly and then said to the House, hey, what are you guys doing?
They're taking a 4-day weekend,
you know,
again,
We just passed the biggest tax cut.
Why are you taking this
Texas history? What are you guys doing over there?
Taking a 4-day weekend that apparently we approved you could do.
Right.
Just kidding.
So, you know.
Anyway.
You know, so there's a lot of this going on, but, you know, so the immediate aftermath of the House going in and doing and passing these bills and sending them over to the Senate with a big ribbon around them, we'll switch metaphors. Yeah. You know, was a flurry of rhetorical bomb throwing by Lieutenant Governor Patrick, by his allies, approval of the House's action by the governor, and really mostly just kind of a satisfied silence from the House. I mean, on social media, Twitter, et cetera, you know, there were some House members kind of strutting, but Speaker himself, you know, a couple of formal statements. We've done our stuff. Look forward to the Senate, you know, ratifying our work. And
Speaker's press people are still responding, but in a very, you know, measured if playful way.
Right, right. Because, and why wouldn't they? Right now, they're probably feeling pretty good.
Right.
So that all led to a press conference that the lieutenant governor held just yesterday. As we record this on Wednesday, he held this presser on Tuesday, and we'll link this to the podcast as well. So, you know, kind of a slight, you know, odd in some ways. I mean, there's a lot of odd things about this anyway. Yeah. But, you know, a little bit of a tour de force, you know, kind of classic Dan Patrick performance, frankly.
Becoming one.
You know, he pressed the advantage on the politics of this and the kind of, you know, in the sense of saying the Senate plan that, you know, that and you know, he advocated a bargaining position here that was basically a combination of compression and the raising of the homestead exemption. But he kind of phrased it as, you know, we want to give more Texans and focus on Texas homeowners rather than giving business, you know, something. And he did, you know, I thought of an effective job of going through the numbers, demonstrating that, you know, he's not just reading from a script. He seems to get what he's advocating here,
yeah,
I would argue.
I think so, for sure.
And I think he took advantage of the fact that, frankly, allowing for the fact that we have now gone down several forks in the road. When we started in, you know, the late fall or the winter of last year and early in the session saying, we have all this money, we can do anything we want with it.
Right.
Now, allowing for the fact that we've gone down a couple of forks to say, and one of the biggest things we're going to do is property taxes, and we'll come back to that. You know, I think there are a lot of people out there in the policy community that think that prefer the lieutenant governor's approach, and not all of them are the usual suspects. Again, given the predicate and the path dependency of where we are now.
Yeah.
You know, he's onto something there, and he leveraged that in the press conference by, you know, quoting press coverage and our friend Mark Jones at Rice and, you know, looking at, I think it was Bob Garrett from the Dallas Morning News giving him the kind of, right, Bob?
Yeah.
Sort of, you know, I mean, a lot of that was really, you know, entertaining, if you will.
Well, it's interesting. In
the- and then just to close the loop, that's also where he mentioned that Dick Levine from Every Texan had been quoted as saying that of these plans, and that's why I'm emphasizing the path dependency, this one is sort of, I think the fair way to put it is probably less advantageous to the top of the income distribution than are the other alternatives.
Well, isn't that just like, okay, like pause for a second, right? I mean, like this is the thing that you find.
That's fair.
I mean, like, and I don't want to use this term because you and I have got, you know, I mean, I'd say you and I, you have a lot of consternation over the use of this term, and I'm going to throw it out there anyway, even though I know you're not going to like it. But it's weird seeing, you know.
I like the term weird.
Wait, you know, it's like Dan Patrick, the populist.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's a sort of, there's an interesting element to this, which basically says, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you've got Dan Patrick's and you're saying, well, you know, the problem with the house plan, you see, is that it helps businesses and rich people too much.
Yeah.
And it's like, now look, facts are facts, right? I mean, this is the difference between if we take $100,000 off the bottom, right?
Yeah.
That becomes a very, I mean, in a lot of ways, that becomes a pretty progressive, you know, basically tax break in a sense, right? If you go,
you know, it's not progressive.
It's not progressive.
It's
but
less
it's,
regressive.
It's, yeah, it's not. Yeah. Well, right. It's regressive because it only affects homeowners. So, I mean, it's still regressive, but it's less regressive than, say, just taking a fixed percentage off whatever the value is or whatever, which obviously then if you're talking about larger values, it ends up being a lot more money. And that's what, if you go into the Dick Levine analysis, that's what you're going to see essentially.
Right.
Is that the compression is going to, the benefits, you can look at the benefits and where they get distributed amongst different income groups in Texas of each policy. And the compression, you know, the benefits, you know, are significantly more skewed towards upper income and people and businesses. But the other side of this, too, is, you know, I mean, what's kind of interesting to me also just sort of in hearing it out loud, because you never hear in some ways policy and politics and such like just base, I mean, like really just base terms. Just like, look, they agreed to a dollar figure, about $12
billion, right,
to cover these this new round of property tax cuts. And really the question just is, you know, and I mean, the way that Dan Patrick put it in a good way is, are we going to give 100% of that to homeowners on their primary residence, to be clear, or are we going to split that up between homeowners and also owners of commercial properties and all this other stuff, right? And look, and then in the end, you say, well, how much is the average homeowner going to save? Well, obviously, if we give 100% of those to homeowners, they're going to save more than if we spread them around. And so the politics of this, I mean, he's, you know, again, he's not wrong. And the other issue, of course, is this thing that you brought up before, you know, to the extent that, you know, and again, it makes for weird, you know, it makes for strange bedfellows, right? Where Dan Patrick is sort of not relying on, but using the analyses of university types, you know, let's just say university types. That's a good broad sweep, you know, in justifying his plan. I mean, you know, ultimately it's just odd, right? I mean, but it's also not entirely wrong, right? In the grand scheme of things, because as we were talking about before, the reason that these sort of university types are kind of siding in a lot of ways with this plan, besides the fact that it's less regressive, is because of what we talked about before. Ultimately, if you go with this compression plan, I want to call it a scheme. I don't love that word, but let's say call it a compression plan. Ultimately, at some point, you know, it creates a governance problem because where does revenue come from? And ultimately, there's no appetite among any of these Republican elected officials to generate new revenue from elsewhere. And so given that, there is an aspect to this that sort of, I mean, to my mind, kind of raises issues of like timelines, like political timelines and sort of the political calculations of the different players involved.
Right. And again, I think we talked about it last week. We've mentioned it a couple times. I mean, you know, there has been admission of this in open court.
Yeah.
That, you know, the political time horizon on this. Now, the governor, but the lieutenant governor in his press conference also used that in an interesting way by basically kind of calling BS on the idea that you're ever going to get property taxes down to zero, that's anything other than a fantasy, right? from his, you know, was the way he paraphrased.
But this is ultimately the issue here, which is that the idea that the Texas legislature is going to do anything that's like politically palatable from the sense that we need functioning government to decrease property taxes in any meaningful and sustainable way, that's the fantasy here that no one really wants to address.
Particularly in the absence of any other significant adjustments in the sources of revenue.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean,
for localities or the state writ large.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. There's no appetite to increase revenues anywhere else. And so part of what it comes down to is, remember, you know, we don't have a statewide income tax. We don't have a statewide property tax. So when they talk about, you know, adjusting property tax rates, what they're really talking about fundamentally is taking on a larger share of the funding that goes to public schools.
Right.
And what's interesting, I mean, the lieutenant governor, you know, and he said this, you know, I mean, for a long time, I mean, he's been really, you know, consistent about this. Whenever anyone would raise in previous sessions, like, oh, why don't you, you know, you we should use, you know, the rainy day fund's getting so big, the economic stabilization fund, or the severance fund, whatever, the severance tax on gas royalties, just to be specific here. He's like, people always say before a session, why don't we use this to give teachers a pay raise? Why don't we use this for this? And the lieutenant governor, and I think this is a reasonable argument, say, hey, look, those are ongoing expenses. We can't just do that with the surplus money over here because we're not going to have it anymore for the next session. That's a continual
bill. You're going to do this. You have to really commit to it and understand what the downstream consequences are.
Right. And what's interesting is that, you know, when you talk about these property tax cuts, because they're totally divorced, you know, at least in the public discussion from any discussion of public school financing, it's almost as if, like, you know, the fact that we're using a budget surplus, money we didn't think we were going to have to do this, it sort of ignores the fact that, you know, we might not have this money next time. This money may not be there, and yet we're on the hook for this. Now, what's interesting about the lieutenant governor's plan in some ways versus the governor's is that, like, if property values continue to go up, it actually eats into that tax cut.
Right.
Right? And so really that tax cut is going to, you know, degrade in value over time so long as property values go up slowly over time or quickly. It doesn't matter. Now, if they go down, that's another story. But assuming that, you know, Texas continues to grow, the economy continues to grow here, housing continues to be a problem in most places where it's pretty desirable to live, it's reasonable to expect property values to continue to increase a little bit, which means the value of this tax cut is just going to go down over time.
Right.
But again, that speaks to kind of the timeline and horizon. I mean, to some extent, to my mind, being someone who just looks at politics without apology, although I apologize about it sometimes, I'm not going to apologize about here. You know, there is something to this, which is to say, you know, if your goal is to deliver a tax cut to voters that they can feel, which is, I think, what the lieutenant governor is really looking for, given he's going to run one more time. I mean, certainly we expect him to run one more time. I don't expect him to necessarily run another time after that. We'll see. I would think not, but let's say he's going to run one more time. The fastest way to make sure you get the most dollars into homeowners' pockets that they can notice is going to be through the homestead exemption.
Right.
But you know, and again, on the other side of it with the compression, the idea is it's like, well, do voters notice that their taxes didn't go up as quick as they have been going up?
Right. And
there's a little bit of, you could have a reduction too, to be fair.
And I 2 points to expand on that. I mean, one, I mean, on the most immediate point, and the lieutenant governor was very clear about that. He said, you know, if we pass the plan that we advocate, it means, you know, something like, I think he said, you know, in the low four figure. I think he's saying between $1,200 to $1,400 per household. And the houses would be much less than that. It's like $700 or in that range. In that, you know, so he was very clear about that. And that, look, I wouldn't quibble with your use of populist in this. I was kind of thinking about it. I mean, you know, in the sense that he is trying to project something that is tried and true in Texas political culture by saying, look, I am a guy who is here. I am looking out for the average person. That's the nub of that appeal. And I think that, you know, I'm here to, like, really help the people that need it, the average person, not these other kind of elitist guys that, you know, for whatever reason, the governor and the House seem to want to help, you know, and he was very direct about
that. Well, even his choice of example saying, you know, like, imagine if you had a $250,000 house. Well, I'm going to tell you, 80% or more of Texas's population lives in or around one of the urban centers in this state, and most of them cannot touch a property for $250,000. Yeah. So, I mean, like, you're not, if you just think about who are you talking to, what does this look like?
How is this going to go over? So, you know, I don't want to beat this to death, but I mean, I think if we look at, you know, so in addition to this kind of pressing the advantage on the politics of a broader, you know, kind of more populist seeming approach, and characterizing his approach as that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I one more beat in terms of, you know, the conflict, this open conflict between the lieutenant governor and the governor. I think people were struck by, you know, how direct the governor is, the lieutenant governor was, even as he kind of popped back and forth. And, you know, and this has been the pattern with them, but it's usually been more muted. But this was very direct, you know, kind of, you know, I mean, you know, and taking notes and looking at that speech, I mean, the, you know, things were, the lieutenant governor was kind of saying, like, look, I don't blame the governor for this. He might not even know what's in the document. He kind of waves the plan around. Or
he's might have been misled.
He's listening to outside people or, you know, either inside people or outside people that are probably deceiving him. So, like, the implication there is, like, you know, the governor doesn't really know what's going on here.
Yeah.
You know, he's just and to your point about the populism, I mean, I hadn't really thought about it in this way. But, you know, we're down here, like, looking out for the people. Governor's just up there. Doing whatever he's doing, listening to these people that are giving him bad advice. And then the delivery is like, let's have a little Lincoln Douglas style debate.
I'm not trying to have a fight.
Yeah.
But I will debate you next Monday or Tuesday.
Yeah, it's not a fight. It's a debate. Next week, I'll be here.
Yeah.
You know, and with a little Lincoln Douglas thing. And, you know, you know, I think I have a pretty good idea of who the lieutenant governor thinks is Lincoln and who he thinks is Douglas in that debate. And for those of you that don't, you know, aren't familiar with Lincoln's Douglas debate, maybe we'll put a link on that too. But so, you know, I mean, to close out, we've been going on for a while, you know, a couple of big picture considerations to close on that we will almost certainly be coming back to in future weeks. I mean, look, you know, you mentioned governance earlier, and I think that is a really major point here. You know, we were talking beforehand. It's a sign that you are having difficulty governing, that you as a party that owns Texas government, lock, stock, and barrel, can't manage to pass the thing that you most prominently promised to everybody in the previous campaign cycle.
Yeah.
And that is property tax reduction.
And in the lead up to the session.
There was nothing, in the campaign, in the victory speeches, in the prepping for the session. You know, the only other thing that competed with property taxes was the electric grid.
Yeah.
Right? And they got something on that done. There's a whole other storyline that happened this week that we're going to have to come back to that Peter Lake resigned as chair of the PUC. Yeah, that's a big story on that. Would take another at least half hour, and I think people are still trying to figure out the ins and outs of that. So, you know, I mean, they've got to, you know, we've been saying for months, if there's one thing they're going to do other than the thing they have to do, the budget, they're going to do property taxes. And here we are with, you know, the news, you know, oddly enough, there's other competing news in Texas politics right now, particularly with the impeachment and in the impending trial of the attorney general. But this is a big sign of failure so far.
Yeah, and I mean,
I don't think there's any other way you can look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think, you know, the reality is that the impeachment of the attorney general, you know, and look, we always, you know, just to take a step back, you know, we sit here and we do this podcast. This podcast is very much, you know, the expectation is the people who are listening to this are already pretty interested in this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So this isn't where you come for your first read, if you will.
Your first dose, yeah.
You know,
it's called second reading for a reason.
Yes. But, you know, so you have to take a step back and think, you know, what are people picking up right now? And it's interesting because if you just sort of take, you know, if you think about it, we know from our polling that, you know, fewer than 1 in 5 voters, probably closer to 1 in 10, are paying a lot of attention to the legislature, even at the end of the session. But the session comes to an end and every newspaper is covered with, you know, Texas House impeaches attorney general. Right. And again, and I think, you know, even people who are just mildly and passingly familiar with politics, like, boy, you know, isn't the state run by Republicans? Isn't the attorney general, like, he must have done something pretty bad.
Yeah.
Right. And then you go and you say, oh, you know, they're also going into a special session immediately because they couldn't agree on property tax cuts, which, and you say, really? Republicans can't agree on property tax cuts? What does that mean? Again, say, nobody cares about the mechanism. Right. Nobody understands the mechanisms, right? And then you chase that with this open conflict, which, you know, you say what you want about the media. People say, oh, the media is biased. Yes, the media is biased, but you know what they're biased towards? They're biased towards this kind of conflict.
Right.
And so you look at that and you look at those three things. And I mean, and I sort of – I hinted at this when we were talking earlier. We don't have to go into it and I don't want to. But like – and there's an overall backdrop to this, which is, you know, we almost defaulted on the debt nationally. You right. know, and the sort of the brinksmanship between the Republican-controlled House of Representatives and the president really getting up to the – you know, if you're just sort of a voter kind of looking around like right now, you might be sort of wondering, WTF? You
yeah,
know?
Right.
Like, you know, what is going on here? Because – this doesn't, you know, this is not going to make sense. And when something doesn't make sense like this, it draws in people to like a little bit more than maybe they might have been drawn in just because of the scandal, because of the dysfunction. And, it, you know, you what you worry about, I think, if you are, you know, in the governing class, if you're part of the majority party right now is, you know, are you, you know, I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but, you know, does it make you look incompetent?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I you know, I think, you know, we as part of this conversation beforehand, we were talking about this. You know, I mean, we've been talking for years, and for good reason, about the internal tensions inside the Republican Party, whether thinking of them as, you know, honest-to-goodness cleavages or, you know, whatever. And I think we talked about it a lot as being kind of a fractal thing almost at this point. But I think one of the things that's interesting, and we'll come back to this, is that, you know, that national, you know, there's this whole national sort of discussion over what happened with the debt ceiling and now – and I think most people are probably not following the follow-up, which is now, you know, some of the dissidents, you know, that have been making Speaker McCarthy at the national level's life miserable are now kind of, you know, doing a little bit of sort of display behavior to make sure everybody notices that they can still be an issue, be a problem, even though they, you know, had to go along with the debt ceiling thing. And then all of this kind of fighting going on over both policy and personal stuff and corruption in Texas. There's an interesting contrast there between, you know, a two-party competitive environment mm-hmm. and what's going on at the national level and the fact that because the parties were more, you know, were competitive with each other, there was something of an agreement that got cut that involved Democrats and Republicans, yeah. you know, basically
sitting there
coming to some kind of agreement that, you know, pissed off the more extreme wings of each party, but that got done. Where in Texas, the dynamic is very different because it's such a non-competitive environment. And all of this fighting that we're seeing right now is really exclusively among Republicans because it's such a one-party dominant environment. And we'll come back. I mean, we've talked about that in the past. We'll come back to that. And I think that's going to make manifest again in pretty significant ways going forward. But it does, you know, the governance problem, and I guess what I would say is that it means that the government, you know, we're seeing governance problems, I think it's fair to say, both the national and the state level.
Yeah.
But the dynamics of those governance problems are really very different.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting.
It's to my mind.
Yeah, and I mean, and I would say, you know, and this specifically to bring it back to Texas, the special session dynamic really intensifies it, right? I mean, because the governor is determining the agenda, Democrats really have nothing to play for here, right? So they have so for example, you know, when you're talking about like the vote over the debt ceiling in the House, I mean, there's this whole sort of, you know, narrative of this where, you know, essentially there are a bunch of Republicans who are like, okay, you know, I can give you my vote if you need it, but I need to see how many Democrats you guys get so that, like, you know, we can see how many people we can release and vote against it and all this business, right? You know, the way that that's working in Texas is solely within the Republican Party. I mean, I think the way that Abbott has set up the special session calls and his signaling around it is, you know, Lieutenant Governor came out and said, here's a list of, you know, whatever, 12, 15 things that we should still do. And instead of the governor saying no, the governor said, okay, here's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this real simple-like, and I'm going to call multiple special sessions, which could literally just be two, this one and the one for vouchers. But who knows? I'm going to call multiple special sessions.
That was the thinking at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. The point is I'm saying he could call multiple special sessions and still completely follow through on what he planned because of the property tax. We could say, I'm going to call multiple special sessions and I'm going to dole out the issues that I want you to deal with one at a time so you guys can deal with it. And we talked about how that sort of was a little bit patronizing, you know.
A little bit, yeah.
But here's the thing too. But from a negotiating standpoint, if he's still negotiating with Republicans to come along, the idea is he needs to hold out, you know, hope for them that some of those other issues might still get called on a special session. If he said, no, this is all gone, then they have nothing to play for. But that shows like the fraughtness of the dynamics in some ways, and that you've got on the one hand, Democrats with nothing to play for in the at the state level in this process. And on the other hand, you have Republicans, you know, again, in the legislative process at different levels, whether you're in the House or in the Senate. You know, in some ways, I mean, not, you know, I don't know how else to say this, but negotiating with a partner in Abbott who has not necessarily demonstrated himself to be super reliable.
Yeah.
And so there's also that dynamic going on here, right? In terms of, you know, is the governor going to call another special session on the issues that I care about that we haven't addressed? Right. Well, or
and,
not?
That was one of the things that was a very interesting swing in the 24 hours between the calling of the special session and the House passing those two priorities, right? Which is, you know, the mood was very much initially the governor saying, legislature, you know, they don't have their act together. Next thing you know, again, and we talked about this last week, the whole unstable triangle thing. Next thing you know, the governor and the Speaker of the House are both like, yeah, we're on the same page.
Yeah, and you know what? If he calls him back for a voucher bill, you know, voucher bill back in, you know,
then it's going to switch.
It's going to switch. Right. You know, but the whole point here is—
And to be fair, Democrats will also play more of a role in that.
Yes, that's right. But how much of a role?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, depending on what that looks like.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there were—
Oh, yeah, more, yeah, they'll play a role in that.
Because there were more Democratic votes on, you know.
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah, and being the main part of the House's opposition.
Yeah, I mean, they'll be a bigger part of the story at that point. But nonetheless, the origin of that is still the fact that, you know, Republicans are governing and, you know, they have a lot of agenda management, you know, ability here. And we should, you know, make sure we add that, of course, at this moment— This is the moment where, you know, the governor has, you know, a lot more initiative in the process than he did in the middle of the session. That's by design.
And that's also why I think, you know, if people are wondering, well, why doesn't the Senate just gavel out and just, you know, kick off basically right. force the governor to another special session to restart the process? And the reason I'd say is because right now this is about politics.
Right. And we should say, and the lieutenant governor's been very straightforward about that.
Yeah.
I mean, at the press conference yesterday in their messaging, we're not going anywhere. We're going to keep working. And they're continuing to work on things that are not on the call.
Yeah.
So that they can demonstrate publicly, particularly to Republican audiences, we are continuing the work and implicitly the work that the House didn't do because they're bad Republicans when we were in the regular session.
I love this dynamic at the end of session and also special sessions in some ways, because it's really interesting where you get to this point where you say, okay, here's this bucket of stuff that our partisans may or may, you know, our partisans or some, you know, important, you know, issue groups within our coalition really wanted.
Yeah.
And then you get this sort of game where it's like, okay, who can take credit for dealing with some of these while casting blame on everybody else? Because we didn't do these other things. And this has happened multiple times. I mean, watch, you know, session after session. I mean, what's interesting about it, I think, and, you know, we could probably just do a podcast just on this dynamic or write a piece about it because it's interesting to me at least, is, you know, you can watch the governor and lieutenant governor, again, who've started together, come along together. You can see them over time adjusting their strategies, you know, each time. And the governor this time is a different strategy he took last time. We talked about this last week. It's a different strategy he took last time. But the outcome and the goal is the same in all cases. In all cases, you know, the House wants to pass a bill and leave and say, hey, we passed a bill. The Senate's holding it up. The Senate's now going and debating a bunch of stuff that's not on the session call while the House isn't here and therefore could not become law in any way,
right?
At least in this session. And basically they can say, hey, you know, we passed all this stuff in the special session, but the House didn't show up. And in the end, the governor, whatever they pass, is going to say, you can thank me for this and everything they didn't do. Well,
on them.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think this, you know, the shifting of all this is always fascinating. And, you know, to the credit to the players, you know, hard to negotiate because there's a lot of fluidity in this. So we will see more in that. And the Senate was in today, this morning, as we're recording this on Wednesday, I wasn't able to watch all of it as I was prepping for this and in and out doing things, but there's a strange sense of business as usual, although, you know, I may hear about something that happened that wasn't quite that, but it, like, yeah, we're just here passing stuff. So, Okay, with that, thanks to Josh for being here. Thanks to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. If you're listening to this on one of the podcasting platforms, you'll find more supplemental material on the blog section that's under the kind of polling division at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. We've referred to links. I'll try to remember all the things I promised and make sure they're in there. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.